Hi, this is Leo. Before you begin listening to this episode, we want to make you aware that we speak at some length about loneliness and suicide. Please consider whether this is a good time for you to listen. Switch it off if you need to, and take good care of yourself if it brings up painful feelings for you.
Welcome to the Autistic License Podcast. I'm Shauna, and I'm in Carrickfergus in Northern Ireland.
I'm Leo in London.
We invite you to listen in on our conversations as we experiment with unmasking in an autistic space. We talk about what it means to discover we're autistic as adults, especially with established careers as therapists. We want people to know that autistic therapists exist and to broaden the conversation about neurodiversity. You're so welcome to join us, whoever you are and wherever in the world you are. We hope you'll find something of interest and connection here.
I've been up since early, six, but that's normal. That's normal. Oh, actually, my fan is on. That's going to make a noise. That's better, I think.
Yes. I got up about six, actually, because I've been sleeping through the night, two nights in a row.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a bit weird.
That's good. Have you reset?
I don't think it's about resetting. And I don't know that it is so wonderful because it kind of means that then when I wake up, I think, oh, it's okay. It's the middle of the night. I can read. I can do my thing. And then I'll go back to sleep again. But now these last two nights have been just waking up going, oh, it's kind of morning time. So I've kind of missed out a little bit.
That's not what you're used to.
That's not what I like.
No.
Not really what I like, but it's interesting. It's probably good. I think it's good for me. Like I had loads of energy yesterday, and I think I've got loads of energy today. So it's always good to kind of realise what it's like to, you know,
be normal.
Yeah.
And I think I would say the same, actually. I can't remember waking up. I mean, I don't wake up in the way that I know you do and, like, do stuff.
Yeah.
But I do regularly wake every 2 or 3 hours. But I have no memory of doing that.
Maybe it's a season change.
Season change.
Because it's bright. It's kind of spring.
It is. And it's certainly, I noticed that this morning, how that it was broad daylight. Very, very early in the morning, and it seemed like ever so recently I was waking up in the dark and taking Woody into the garden in the dark. So that is nice.
What are you looking at now?
I was checking, two things. There was a siren, just for a change. Welcome to Tottenham. And I was seeing if it was raining or not, because we had some fine rain before. Okay. The last time I was out in the garden, last couple of times I was out.
What do you want to talk about?
I have no idea. No idea at all.
You're in the house on your own. So, yeah, what's that been like?
Up and down. There's been, what do I like? I like being able to leave things where I can leave, being practical.
Uh-huh.
Like the dining table is usually clear or should be clear. And if I leave things there, they appear in my room on a chair. Put this away. And that's fine if I'm just being messy, and I can be messy, but often it's a practical thing.
Okay.
So, like, what's out there now? Dog medicine is out because Woody's been feeling a bit dodgy for a couple of days. So rather than go into the drawer where we keep that stuff, I can leave it out. Things are to hand in the way that I would like them. And that's obviously mostly a subjective thing. Okay. Sometimes it's aesthetics versus practicality. Uh-huh. And I randomly fall on either side of that divide myself. It's not predictable, and I don't claim to be consistent. Back to consistency again. But so that's one thing. And sleeping actually. So that's probably relevant. You know, I'm sleeping well. That's because I can have whatever lights on I want, or have the telly on or not. Temperature is to my liking at any particular moment, noise and light, all of those things. So everything is to my comfort.
To your comfort.
And I don't have to compromise anything. Uh-huh. So that probably helps sleep. I'm lonelier than I thought I'd be, quicker than I thought I'd be.
Uh-huh.
And for more of the time than I thought I'd be.
Okay. You want to talk about that?
Although I think the only point that, or the only sense I made of it was, you know, why would I have moments, and they tend to be off guard moments, of thinking, oh, I'm really sad. Why am I sad? There's nothing bad going on. Rachel's away on holiday having a nice time. So, yeah, what's the problem? Why I'm not thinking about being on my own. When I do think about on being on my own at the moment, it's for a relatively short period of time, and it's advantageous in most areas. I can just do as I please. I think these are kind of flashbacks to very long periods of time when I did not want to be on my own. Long time ago, 15 years ago, when I did live on my own, not out of choice particularly. I didn't enjoy being on my own. And now when it happens, it's all right. It's a choice, usually, and it's very rare. And so there are nice things to be had from it, knowing that it's finite as well. I wouldn't want it to be infinite. That's another thing I think I am realising as well. I don't actually long-term still enjoy being on my own. And I think that's something that I think I used to put down to living on my own for like 15 years before was not a choice. It's still that my choice would still not to be on my own, generally speaking, in the long term.
And the sadness that comes along, you're saying the sadness is to do with it being like a flashback and it reminds you of that time. Could the sadness, is there any elements of the sadness just that something is finding its way in that wouldn't normally find its way in because you're occupied or more easily distracted?
I wouldn't know, I suppose, because this would be the first time that I've asked myself that. Well, you're asking myself that question. You're asking myself?
I can see how you've come to the conclusion that it's like a memory thing, but I just wonder if it's also just giving you time to be present with yourself in the now that you don't normally
get. That's correct. But that idea of being on my own and, you know, having the chance to be with myself without distraction for a decent period of time, which, you know, you rightly say just hasn't happened for a decade and a half, really. Even when I've been away, like I was a year and a half ago and I went on a study weekend, I was with other people.
Yeah.
Most of the time, except when I was, gone to my room to go to bed. So I don't know that anything in particular has come to me other than those historical or feelings that I've felt historical. But you're right. I don't know what that might be in the here and now. I don't know.
It's interesting, because I wonder what I would be like if I was on my own. I don't know how to get that, because I'm usually always with Lana.
Which is a different kind of, and I'm not going to call it a different kind of alone, but it's a different situation in that that's not contemporary, and I don't mean to patronise her in any way at all, but it's not contemporary adult company.
Oh, yeah, I know what it's like not to have adult company, but I know what that's like. But it's still not the same loneliness, because obviously there's still, like, lots of distraction and lots of checking in with each other. And, you know, there's somebody else always in the house. So it's not the same as living on your own. And I can't really, like, go into, I suppose that's why I like being up in the middle of the night, because then I can go into, like, a big reverie kind of thing with myself.
Oh, I love that word.
It's a lovely word. Or if I get up early and she's not up now that she's a teenager, then I can do things like that in the morning time. And even, like, I guess, though, whenever Ricky and I were living together, he worked such long hours. And we would also, like, easily spend time separately at weekends and stuff. Like we often say we spend more time together now than we did for a lot of years, especially whenever Lana was little, and like one of us would take her out somewhere and the other one would, you know, get the house into some kind of order. So things change at that stage. But I guess that I don't have a big need for adult company all the time, like really. Mm-hmm. And I had, like, I lived in, I don't know, I think I lived with about 30 people in shared houses over the period of like 7 years or something. I remember working it out.
Not all in one go, you mean over a period of time.
I mean, sometimes whenever you take partners into consideration, it could seem like you were living with 30 people. Sure, but sure. I lived with quite a lot of people in a lot of shared houses in my 20s before Ricky and I got together. And I always felt like I couldn't be with those people as often as many of them could be with each other. So I'd have always been the one that wouldn't join everybody in the living room, because I'd had so much stimulation during the day that I would just need to be in my own room. So, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I don't have a big need, I don't think, for adult company. So I think I could live on my own, but I never have had the chance to do it because I suppose when I was that age, I couldn't afford it, you know, because I was a student and then I was in not very well paid jobs. And then I was obviously with Ricky. And then now Lana's going to be with me for as long as she wants to be with me. So I'll not have the chance, apart from if, you know, I decide to take myself off on my own or she goes away for a weekend or something. I'll not have the chance to see what that's like or to see if that's any different. Like if I was actually left alone for a length of time, would stuff come up for me that isn't already coming up in some shape or form? And I don't know the answer to that, but I don't feel worried about it. Like I could seem like you're kind of saying you wouldn't want to be on your own. I could see myself on my own.
Well, I could. And I still obviously don't know. It's 3 days. What kind of average can I get from that after 15 years? So that's why I'm partly thinking, okay, this is a lot of this is just an echo of being extremely unhappy, like unwell, unhappy for a very long time.
And it was, it was 15 years ago and it was for a 15 year period. That's what
pretty
you're
much,
saying.
Yeah.
Because you kind of said the 15 years and I think I've got mixed up, but
no, you're
actually
right.
Saying it was,
both.
It was a 15 year period and it was 15 years ago.
That's
so a
right.
Significant amount of adult life.
Very much
being
so.
On your own.
Very much so. And there's no real useful point of comparison between then and now, because this has been 3 days, and it might be that I were to settle into something if it were longer term, and that would feel very different. But my instinct is not. My instinct is that I'm taken back to realizing at that time that, you know, that my natural state is to be in communication with people, to be with people,
to be living with someone. Because I think that I wouldn't say that I don't need to be in communication with people. I do need to be in communication with people. I'm not sure that I need to be living.
No, I meant that specifically. Yeah, I meant that specifically. I think that the possibility is, and I can't know unless I'm on my own for an extended period of time, but I suspect that I would spin out and it would be unpleasant. And it's like, and this does kind of come back to what we've spoken about before in terms of co-regulation.
Yeah.
You know, we have a particular experience of that, but just generally speaking, without any co-regulation, can I be regulated? There you go. There's a question for the here and now. I have no idea. But my instinct is no, I can't.
Even with the dogs, if you
that's
were to
one,
have pets.
That is actually one of the other lovely things, is having them to myself. Not that there's ever any kind of battles between who gets a cuddle or anything, but the fact that it's just the three of us, me and the two dogs, is very nice, and there's constant communication in that way.
Yeah.
I am enjoying that, absolutely. But am I enjoying that because that's better than nothing? And the nothing is an awful thing to contemplate. There's no useful outcome, really, to these thoughts. It's a very short period of time. It isn't normal life. And you know, as I say, my suspicion is this is an echo back to a time when I was unhappily unwell.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about what would I be like. And I think that definitely in the future, I would always have either my current cats or I would have other cats. Like, I don't think I'd want to live on my own without cats. Like, I do think that would probably feel lonely. Like, why would I do it? It doesn't make any sense to do it. But I don't think that I need human company. You know, I think that the quality of my relationships would need to be good, of course, and that would deal with my, if there was any loneliness. But I don't actually think, like, I think people coming in and out and having, I don't think I need it for regulation. I think I can be regulated. And I guess I never always had cats, but now that I have them, I know that they're part of my regulation. But I don't, yeah.
It's a fair point about the pets thing, that and I hadn't considered that. That definitely is different. And when I did live on my own for an extended period of time, I didn't have any pets, and so I was completely on my own. There's definitely a difference that presence, and actually that was what I was going to pick up on, that you said company, human company, and I think it is presence more than company. But it's a synchronization of nervous systems, is one way that you've described it before, which makes a lot of sense. There's the needs or the lack of need for conversation and to and fro. That's what I mean, I think, about the difference between companionship in the way that most of the world experiences it. That being with people is a very social and probably active thing for a lot of the time. And what I'm learning is important to me, and I hear this from autistic people, is presence. And again, it's that thing about parallel play or just moving around each other. These are phrases that come up quite a lot.
Yeah, I guess that if I was ever going to live with somebody, I'd need that presence, not company, because I think company was what I didn't want, I didn't need in student houses the way that other people seem to need. But I think there was also an extroversion, introversion thing going on there as well. And for whatever reason, I seem to live with a lot of extroverted people and I was introverted. Because neurodivergent people who are extrovert are different in what their needs are for that than introverted neurodivergent people. Because I definitely lived with some undiagnosed neurodivergent people as well who are flashing into my mind right now. And if any of you are listening, you'll never know who you are because there's so many of you.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's interesting because it's as if you're kind of also saying that you do need company or else, like, maybe, like, because you'll slide or you'll spiral. It's still better to have company around you than not, because you might spiral. And I'm not convinced that I would spiral. I think I could spend a really long time on my own with just, like, very targeted interaction, a phone call or a meetup. I think that's kind of why I don't need to see people very often. And then it kind of fills me up for a long time.
That's definitely the case with socialising for me. That needs to be contained. And I suppose I've extrapolated from that being on my own for decent periods of time, like I am now, I'd say a week is a decent period of time, would be comfortable. And I think I'm finding, as I say, after only four days, actually 3.5 days, that it's not consistently comfortable.
And maybe it doesn't have to be. Like, maybe it depends on your comfort threshold as well. Because I guess I wouldn't be looking for comfort. People always used to be like, you know, do you not want to be happy? And I'm like, necessarily. Do you know, like, there's higher values for me than being happy or being comfortable or content. Like, I want to push the edges of feeling and experience. And it's not actually, I mean, obviously I wouldn't want to be crying the whole time. Like, so I wouldn't want to be really distressed. But I wouldn't not do something because I was going to have days when I was going to be uncomfortable. Because you have days when you're uncomfortable, even when you are around people. Like,
of course.
You ever going to get it right? I don't know.
No, and I'm not. I don't think I'm idealistic in that way, that I need to. I certainly don't need to be happy all the time. And it's come back to therapy goals again. I don't. That's not the point of therapy. Is not to be happy. It's to be okay for as much of the time as possible. That's my, you know, that's, I suppose, what I would strive for, to be fundamentally okay. I don't think I have desires to hide from unpleasant or uncomfortable feelings, emotions, experiences. But I think I probably was, and I hope this doesn't sound overblown, I think it was a traumatic experience to be alone for many, many years, not out of choice. And so the prospect of that, even in these short little snippets of time that I'm experiencing at the moment, that is why it feels, I think, quite, you know, echoes from the past, the historic feelings. I don't, you know, that was beyond uncomfortable. That was horrible and infinite. You know, there was no end in sight year on year on year. So to get a little snippet of that, just flick into the back of my mind while I'm relaxing, eating what I want, being with my dogs, all the lovely things that I get to experience this week, I kind of suddenly go, oh, no, I don't want that, don't want that.
It does sound traumatic, doesn't it? It sounds like,
I think, a
trauma memory that comes, because that's what trauma memories
are. Yes, it is. It's very, you're right. Thank you for reminding me, actually. That is why I'm using that word, is because it's very immediate.
And it's sensory, and
yes,
it's got that quality of something that's not properly processed and is still very alive, waiting to be triggered. Well, either waiting to be triggered or waiting to be healed. It's in that part of your brain.
And it's a weird one, actually, to think of in terms of trauma, using to use that kind of paradigm, because normally, a traumatic experience is, you know, maybe perceived as life-threatening. Well, I suppose this was in a long, drawn-out
way.
Mental health. Actually, no, really, yes, there were definitely times when I hadn't had enough. But, yeah, normally there is an event. So if you're going to, say, use EMDR to tackle, you know, you need a specific memory, or at least
for
one at a time
trauma.
To focus. Yeah, yes, yes,
for
yeah, yes,
trauma,
yes. Yeah, this would more be, I suppose, along the lines of what you might experience in terms of neglect or something like that, longer term, ongoing. And that's not, you know, I am not making a direct comparison there. That would be kind of obscene.
I think it's okay. No, I think it's okay to use that in some ways. Your emotional and psychological health was neglected, without blaming anyone. Of course, you were an adult. But it was neglected to the point that you could have been, you know, receded away, lost, like a neglected person, you know. And it also affected your physical health, and there was
a lot of wake-up calls
in that sense as well.
That's right.
A kind of a complex trauma. It's not, it doesn't fit with developmental because you weren't a child, but it's that kind of chronic ongoing experience of trauma that is not like a shock, like an event, but it's still a trauma. A trauma is just something that's overwhelming to your system, and that you don't have anybody present to help you to regulate you and help you, give you hope to get through it. So it totally hits those kind of definitions.
So there's a thing. What we've asked this question in very profound ways before. What would it have been like if we'd have known each other at particular points in our lives? Now, I wonder about that particular time, because the reason I bring that up is there was no time when I was just regulated. I was very sociable. So, I mean, I may, for anyone who doesn't know, be given the impression I was on my own all the time. I was almost never on my own because I would go and see people, have visitors every single day. I can go back to my diary from then now and see how busy I was. Every single day there was something. And I was working for much of that time, not all of it, but I'd be going to work and then I'd be socialising. But that's not congruent, authentic me. That's hyped up, keeping myself distracted, sociable me. Yeah. So there wasn't a moment where I was just regulated by the again, the presence versus kind of company.
Yes.
And company is probably a fine word as well, but I just can't think of another one that means very actively socialising. Well, socialising, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was either socialising and being distracted, like really heavily making sure I was distracted, because behind that was the dread of this is finite and I'll be going home.
And then
swinging completely the other way to miserable loneliness and despair.
Yeah.
Oh, God, this is pathetic, isn't it, when you say it out loud? It's
not pathetic
at all.
No,
literally pathetic. Literally pathetic. I don't mean that in a judgy way.
What do you mean, literally pathetic? It brings out pathos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, define that then, because pathetic sounds like you're putting yourself down.
That it was a horrible situation to be in, kind of hopeless and genuinely misery-making. There was not a lot of light relief in there, really, or what there was very highly energetic and still not congruent. And so that's what I mean when I say about what would it have been like to know you or to be with an autistic person at that time where there was just presence. So I could have been sad, processed sad things, but not in this desperate state of not being able to bear being alone.
The parts of you that took you out and socialised, and you know that they helped you survive. It was all that you had to get through those times. And you know, it might now look like that's a substitute for something that you hadn't yet accessed, whether that was good therapy or relationships. But it did what it could so that you weren't overcome. Because imagine you hadn't had that. You might have killed yourself because you'd have had all the nights on your own, all the evenings on your own, as well as the nights on your own. So, you know, we can't dismiss all of that, you know. And during those years when you were with people, you might have had some good times, like you were active.
100%.
You did
Absolutely, definitely true.
All of that was happening. But you're saying that you missed out on the presence of whether that was a therapist or a friend or whoever that was to be with you during that time.
I would never have put therapist in that category, actually. That would have been such a small snatch of time, even though it would have been regular. So there would have been regulation in terms of that would always be on the horizon. But I don't know.
Well, good therapy will kickstart the neural pathways, which lasts in between sessions.
That's true. And I did have my first adult experience of therapy during that time. It was contained, you know, for 3 months. But actually, it was the kickoff for me ending up as a therapist in the first place. And it did kick off lots of processes, actually, and processing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So actually, that's fair enough.
Yeah. What years is that? You know, I'm going to do one of my kind of, where was I?
If I talk specifically about the time when I had my ACT therapy with a psychologist, that was 2008. I can tell you exactly when, because I still have the written work that I did, and it'll be dated.
So the 15 years that you're referring to is the 15 years before that, so it's like 93 to 2008. Is that what you're
sorry, this wasn't at the end. The end was 2010.
Yeah, so around what I just said.
So, there. 95 to 2010,
95 to 2010. I was around a lot of people. That's probably the time when I was around the most people as well, because that was my kind of year after leaving school, through until Lana was one. So there was probably a lot of people around at that time as well. And not a hell of a lot of co-regulation with me either, but I guess. And that was, you know, I was suicidal in 95. So that was also, there was a lot of depression. Though I had lots of time to process things like that, because I was, that was my student days. I could feel all of that then. Yeah. It's interesting. Probably wouldn't have been a particularly co-regulating presence.
Your experience, I guess, of, I don't know if you'd call it loneliness, but aloneness.
I guess, but
I'm thinking of just much, much earlier.
I definitely was a lonely child. Definitely was a lonely child and a lonely young teen. Once I kind of got to like 16, I was more kind of popular, more social, did not feel lonely. And that's whenever I kind of got co-opted into the whole church scene, which at that stage gave me a whole lot of belonging and, self-esteem in that kind of way. And definitely for a few years then, took me away from risky mental health that I could have got into. Mm-hmm. I'd say at 14, 15, I would have been headed for major depression and a very low period of struggle. But then that did lift me out of that for those few years to it again whenever I was 19, when I was away from home, 19, 20. But yeah, it wouldn't, none of that really felt lonely. It was more the earlier stuff. Yeah, you're right. I'd say lonely definitely in early teens and that kind of beginning of puberty kind of stage would have been really lonely and not fitting in and being sent to a school that I was totally different to everybody, which was a class kind of a thing, mostly a class kind of a thing. People were a lot better off than I was and didn't come from, you know, the area that I came from. So, like, even my accent was different and definitely social status. And that was really clear, as well as people being a lot more mature than I was. So a lot of that definitely made me feel very lonely, very young. I don't know that I've felt lonely as an adult.
And then there's the thing I think that we both recognise personally and at work. Talking to neurodivergent people of that kind of loneliness, of the loneliness of difference, not fitting in, feeling like an alien.
In work context?
Well, sorry, when I say work, I mean that we get, the people that we work with will talk about these things.
Talk about?
The loneliness of difference.
The people that we work with in therapy will talk about those kind of things.
That's right.
Depending on their jobs, I guess.
I'm not talking about work. Sorry, I meant our work. Forget that bit. I'm just saying
really
that.
Understand.
No, I was clumsy in my phraseology. All I'm saying is that you and I will have an experience of the loneliness of difference, just as our clients also do. So we get to talk about that. You know, I get lots of affirmation of my own experience pre-autism awareness in my own mind from talking to people who have very, very similar experiences of growing up just always feeling different. So even that I suppose what I'm doing is moving on from the idea of loneliness about being alone, about there not being people around, or about some kind of neglect, but just the loneliness of not fitting in, not feeling that you are the same as everybody else. So there could be people around all the time and they could all be being really positive and nice to you, but you can still feel like an alien and you can still feel very lonely. And, you know, because you're not seen or you're not understood.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think that must also have been a really big factor. I think I can only speak about my own experience.
Yeah, and so many autistic people, it's not just, it's not what we're saying about there's people around, but you feel lonely. A lot of autistic people are literally isolated, so they literally will not see anybody from day to day, week to week, and have lost hope. Because maybe they can get the company, but they can't get the presence. And it's not, it's just not worth it to keep on trying and keep on trying. And so many people are stuck in that, because where do you go and how do you get out of that? And it makes so much sense, like, what comes first, you know? Is it mental health difficulties, or is it a hostile society that it's almost like inevitable? And that's why our life expectancy is so short as well. Like, everything that you're kind of describing that you went through, you know, the physical and mental health difficulties of being on your own, and, you know, we've mentioned suicide, you know, as a very real option for a lot of autistic people. I mean, the statistics are sky high, you know, and most of us will not reach the same life expectancy of our contemporaries because we're autistic. Like, that's known about, yes, you know, for so many reasons.
And just to be clear, you're not talking exclusively about suicide here. You're talking about the health impacts in all kinds of physiological ways.
In lots and lots of ways. But yes, mental health has a toll on physical health as well.
Exactly.
And our suicide rates are higher than the general population, a lot higher than the general population. And then you add that to other intersectionalities, you know, the queer community as the kind of one of the most obvious ones. But, you know, obviously more marginalisation is more risk of mental and physical health difficulties. Yeah, a lot of people, I suppose, don't really know that or haven't really heard that in such stark terms.
No. But,
yeah.
And I have, you know, I think about that. And I find myself then in a dilemma about whether it's helpful or harmful to talk about that. Because if you're already in a what feels like a hopeless state, and then you start ruminating on life expectancy and suicide rates, more people need to know, that's for sure.
Well,
the general population needs to have an understanding of the profound impacts on all aspects of health of difference.
Yes. People need to know that. But actually, people themselves, I mean, it's like training in, you know, working with suicide 101 is, if you bring it up, it's not going to be the first time the person's going to have thought about it.
So, no, absolutely.
You don't avoid talking about it. And I think that as autistic people, most of us have thought about it pretty early in life. I was thinking about suicide from my early teens. I had I was actively suicidal at 19, 20, and I had no life expectancy beyond the age of 25 until I was 25 and really confronted that. Like, that was how bleak my outlook was, that I would have killed myself before I became an adult. That's just felt like fact.
Felt inevitable.
It felt inevitable. It felt like fact. And that may be shocking to our non-autistic listeners, but I imagine it's not that shocking to a lot of our autistic listeners. Because that is the experience of growing up autistic. You kind of, it gets so unbearable, and you think it round and round and round in circles, and suicide is an option, a very real option.
And not to try to whitewash that or paint it as a positive, but it is important, and I know I talk about this in my work a lot, that partly the ability outside of the taboo of mortality generally and suicide in particular, the ability to be able to think about it, I think, is a protective factor in a lot of cases, because the way I put it is, it's easier to stay if you know you can go.
Totally, really good. Yeah,
and my comparison with that I always use is claustrophobia.
Yeah,
that, you know, if you put me in a very small contained room with no windows and, you know, physically comfortable enough, but you say, right, I'm locking the door now and I'll come back for you in 2 hours. I know that I would lose my shit very, very quickly, because I am claustrophobic, for one thing. But if you told me to be there for 2 hours, but you didn't lock the door and you left it open a little bit, I could stay there for 4 or 5 hours, probably, needs for the toilet aside. It wouldn't be a problem because I'd have a sense of agency and a sense of control, which again is a dialed up need if you feel different.
Yeah.
And I'd just have comfort around that. That'd be okay. Exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how this could go off on a great big sidebar. But when suffering of any kind is completely outside your control, it's so much more difficult to tolerate, if not impossible to tolerate. So that thing about the claustrophobia thing, and this is why I associate it with suicide, is that for most neurotypical people for whom this subject is still taboo, that's a lot more risky a position to be in if you have a really profoundly difficult time in your life, because you'll push that thought away and push that thought away. To me, that makes it more likely that in a moment of crisis, you may do something rash and unconsidered. But the ability to go, okay, if it gets this bad, I know I can go. And that makes staying easier. And so from that perspective, I think of it as a protective factor.
I was going to say in IFS, when we work with suicidal parts, we very much find that they say a similar thing to what you're saying about the protective factor. We see them more as extreme protectors, so like firefighters is the traditional IFS wording for it. But it is those ones that they provide an option, and they've got a really, really good intent at bottom. Like, you can kind of say, oh my goodness, you're going to kill me, but actually their intent is to keep you alive often. they're there to give you something to consider, to give you an out, to give you a way to talk about and to explore the possibility of not being here anymore, the possibility of, you know, something needs to be killed off, you know, might not be you, but something needs to be killed off. And you know, these parts can help to get real about what that might need to be, you know. And it could be a thought, it could be a way you're seeing yourself, it could be a job that you need to leave, it could be anything, but they need to be there to tell you how intolerable the thing is, and they need to be engaged with directly, not shoved down and suppressed.
Right.
Otherwise, they will behave in the way that you're saying, in an impulsive kind of way. Because a suicidal part can be a very active part. You know, obviously, there's some passive. I had a lot of passive suicidal feelings. You know, I didn't want to be here, but I wasn't going to do anything. But it's whenever you got that combined with a fight response or an impulsive response, that's the risky bit, because it could just happen any day, and that's why when people are volatile or impulsive, or they've got a very aggressive or fight part active, which can also be a functional reaction to trauma, that they're much higher risk than whenever they're like slumped in bed feeling like life's not worth living, like they're not actually going to do anything to themselves. Doesn't mean it's not shitty, but it's being able to properly assess the risk and then work in whatever way you need to with ourselves or with the other person to manage that. So a bit of a tangent there. But I do think that what you said about, like, we need to look at it, because where's it going to go? And I had looked at this by the time I was 25, and I've never been suicidal since. And I reckon that if I hadn't looked at it in those early years, I would still be looking at it now. Like, it's not going to go away. It needs to be faced and worked through.
And here we are. We're still here.
Here we are. We're still here. Now, some people would argue that we are going to put ourselves in an early grave because we do listen to so much stuff. So I guess that's also a very real thing to consider, is the impact vicariously of, you know, doing this work.
That we expose ourselves to way more trauma, even though, as you say, vicariously, second hand or even third hand, than almost all other humans, probably.
And then if you work with neurodivergent or marginalised people, even more so, because they're all traumatised.
Even more so, but if you are working with them as a neurodivergent person, So yeah. much of that is affirming, isn't it? I'm not saying it balances out. How could you measure that? I don't know what the unit of measurement is for vicarious traumatic experience versus affirmation of your identity.
Well, I think you do different, there's different strands of the therapy. So I'd say that it's not all, it's all affirmative, yeah. But we still, I still work with more trauma than the average therapist that I know works with because of my client population.
Yes, yes. And I don't know if you meant this specifically because you do work specifically with trauma, but also, as you say, because all autistic people that we see are going to have some experience of trauma, and circling right back to the beginning, if nothing else, the loneliness of difference.
Yeah, which often is played out in our therapy room because we might be the first person who they've felt the same as.
Usually, I would say.
Often, yeah.
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 More often than not.
More often than not.
Yeah. Which is why we need autistic therapists.
Yeah, and why we need to look after ourselves and why we usually don't work as crazy hours as it might, well, the demand is for, and you know, and I guess some expectations are for, but I think it's why I dig my heels in hard about the need for self-care and the need for time off and, you know, not to get caught up in that, because I'm very aware of the risks of vicarious traumatization. And no matter how good you are and how trained you are and how well supervised you are, that we're still around that a lot.
Yes.
Well, on that cheery note, are we going to stop the tape?
Thank you for listening to the Autistic License podcast. You can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook at autisticlicense.com, or by email at autisticlicense@gmail.com. And we spell license the British way, L-I-C-E-N-C-E. We also have a thriving Facebook community. Search for Autistic License Shauna and Leo, or click on the link in the show notes.